TNT News and Talk with Dolores Cahill on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome, everyone, to the Dolores Cahill Show on tntradio.live. And you can follow me on custodian.com. And also, I have a new Telegram channel, Dolores Cahill. I'd be delighted if you would join me there. So today's show is a little bit unusual. I am handing over the hosting to one of the great minds in science today. And it is Kevin Corbett, who has been on the show before. Good morning, Kevin. And I'd be delighted if you'd like to introduce yourself and your guests.
Good morning, Dolores, and thank you very much for inviting us on. And I'll do my best being your deputy today. I feel like I'm your deputy. And on the show today, we've got a really great lineup, a team of brilliant minds who are going to talk about the issues of virology. And I'm Dr. Kevin Corbett. I'm a general nurse and health scientist, retired, and I've been working around these issues over the last couple of years, but well before the COVID era, in the last 30 years with HIV and AIDS. So shall I kick off, Dolores? Is that okay? Good.
Yes, we're a team.
So today's show is about virology. This is a practice, really, not really a scientific discipline. And the practice of virology has ignored the science, the modus operandi of science, the way science should be done, and has invented this whole concept of an infective pathogenic virus as the causation of human illness. And this idea of the pathogenic virus has been continually rebutted throughout its history, but it's now become an ideology. It's become an ideology, a belief system. And previously it was funded by very important institutions like the Rockefeller, Carnegie, and now the Gates Foundation, and all the others. And they've capitalized on this whole concept of pathogenic virus within the biotechnology and the pharmaceutical industry. And these have become vested interests that have captured all of our regulatory agencies. And they're pumping all these deadly products into the populations, the vaccines, the injections, the antivirals, all based on what really is belief system, ideology, without any proper scrutiny or any probable cause. So within the last 2 years, people have heard a lot about the issues in virology. A lot of the truth movement, I think, in my view, and the freedom movement have really not questioned enough this whole concept of there being pathogenic viruses. And I'd like to introduce some people today who are going to, some key people who are going to talk about these issues. And I'll just quickly run through who's going to be on the show today. We're going to have Mike Stone, who's a health and wellness coach, who's created a website, a blog website called virology.com. And he's deconstructed all the major tenets of virology and shown how they are fraudulent in science in terms of the research designs and the problematic. And we have also Eric Coppolino, who's an investigative journalist and astrologer, who's written a lot about this over the last couple of years. He's created a COVID timeline, an archive of what's happened in the last 2 years, which is very novel. And he's also interviewed key people in the whole of the COVID issue, including Stephen Buston, the PCR expert. And we've also got Dr. Mark Bailey. Dr. Mark Bailey is the husband of Dr. Sam Bailey, and both are former medical practitioners and research physicians. They emanate from New Zealand, where they produce videos, articles, and books that challenge the mainstream medical claims about germ theory and the existence of viruses. They also speak out continuously against the harms of pharmaceuticals and the many aspects of allopathic medicine. And their work can be found at drsambailey.com and in the best-selling book, Virus Mania. But we'll also advertise our own websites and publications as we speak. So first of all, I'd like to call upon Mike Stone. Can you kick off, Mike?
Yeah, definitely. Thanks, Kevin, and thank you, Dolores, for having us here. I'm excited to be a part of this because I get to speak about virology and whether or not, whether or not it's a science or a pseudoscience. And so I'm going to bear with me. It's 4 a.m. here, so I'm still not quite certain. I'm not in a
absolutely
lucid dream
Kevin.
Right now, but I'm going to
do
my best.
Thank you for getting up so early, Mike. You're a real hero. Thank you.
You're welcome. It's a fun experience. So bear with me. But so I'm going to do my best Dr. Jordan Grant impression here. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him, but if you're not, please go to my website. It's virology.com. I'll spell it. It's virology.com. And if you click under my presentations tab, you'll see an excellent two-part presentation that he did called Science, Pseudoscience, and the Germ Theory of Disease, where he breaks down whether or not virology is a science or a pseudoscience. So I highly recommend that. But I guess to begin with virology, let's look at the definitions for what is science and pseudoscience to begin with. And so I wrote these down. For Merriam-Webster, from the dictionary for what science is, it's knowledge or a system of knowledge covering general truths on the operation of general laws, especially as attained and tested through the scientific method. And that's important just to keep in mind the scientific method as we go through this. Pseudoscience, on the other hand, which, you know, basically means fake science. The definition from Oxford for pseudoscience is that these are theories, ideas, or explanations that are represented as scientific, but are not derived from science or the scientific method. So they have this common denominator here where we see the scientific method and whether or not this is applied appropriately. So if you have science, it's going to follow these general guidelines of scientific method. If it's pseudoscience, you're not going to see that. So that kind of gives us a starting point on where we can go from here. The scientific method. So what is this? So this is a, you know, I actually got into a debate with someone saying that these rules don't exist, but they do. It's been around since the 17th century. And it's a set of guidelines or principles that all researchers are supposed to follow. And I've seen them anywhere from, you know, 5 general procedures on up to 7. So it just kind of depends on where you look. But I'll give basically an overview of what these steps entail and whether or not virology actually adheres to the scientific method. And so just to start off with, the first step would be observing a natural phenomenon. And so what this would entail would be, you know, if you're going outside, you see, you know, you observe an apple fall from a tree and you're questioning what could have caused that. You know, that's observing a natural phenomenon. Or, for instance, using a tree again, what if you go outside and you see it's on fire? You know, was it struck by lightning? Was there a match lit near it? Something had to cause a tree to come on fire. So you're observing this effect and you want to determine the cause. With virology, you know, they already run into problems with this first step because virologists cannot observe a virus in nature. You know, there's no ability to find these particles that they assume are viruses. They cannot see them. They don't observe the virus particles, you know, floating through the air, going through a person's nose, hijacking their body, their cells, replicating, and then being, you know, spewed out from them as they talk or cough. This is all theoretical. They don't observe this process play out in any sense of the imagination. So they already run into problems with this first step. And, you know, when you observe that phenomena. You have to understand that this is not something that, you know, it's something natural. It's not created in a lab. You know, the investigators aren't going through and creating these phenomena. They're not manipulating them. This is something that they're supposed to observe. And with virology, they don't do that. So the second step would be, after observing this natural phenomena, you would create a hypothesis called the alternate hypothesis. And in order to do so, you need a few things. You need an independent variable, which is your presumed cause, you know, the thing that you believe is causing this observed phenomena, and the dependent variable, which is the effect. And so here again, we see that virology runs into problems because they do not have this independent variable, which would be, in this instance, purified and isolated virus particles. They don't have that. So again, they're running into problems since they have methods that they can use, whether it's you know, centrifugation, filtration, precipitation, chromatography, different methods that they can use to try and separate the particles they believe are viruses from, you know, directly from the fluids of a human. They just don't do this. Or if they do, they do it a little bit, but they then subject it to cell culture, which we'll get into later, which is an invalid procedure. So they don't find these virus particles directly in the fluids of a human. So they don't have a valid independent variable. The dependent variable, which they get through with their cell culture process, is called the cytopathogenic effect, which is not, again, it's not a natural phenomenon. It's something that's created in a lab. And I'll explain that in a little bit as well. So we're running into problems with the scientific method from the first two steps. You know, they can't even get to the point of creating a hypothesis because they do not observe the virus going into someone in order to cause them to become sick. So along with creating an alternate hypothesis, you'd have your null hypothesis, which, you know, if you believe a virus causes disease, so your hypothesis, these particles cause this disease, these symptoms of disease, the null hypothesis would be that these particles do not cause this disease. After that, we get to testing and experimentation, which again, virology would not be able to get to without having that independent variable that the researchers can vary and manipulate in order to see if it's causing the effect that they're observing. After we do testing and experimentation, they would, you know, observe, or they would make their observations, they'd get their data, they'd analyze it. And after that, you know, they would test to see if the hypothesis is valid or if it's invalid. And so, as I said, this whole process does not, or is not carried out in science. So, or not in science, in virology. So technically it would not be a science, it'd be a pseudoscience. Now, as they do not have their purified and isolated particles, they're you know, their valid independent variable, what they don't have, you know, direct evidence for the existence of the particles that they assume are a virus. So what they do is they go through indirect evidence, various modes of indirect evidence to try and prove that these viruses exist. So just to break down, direct evidence would be, you know, that the, you know, the evidence that can prove your point that does not require the interpretation of the, you know, the person, the investigators or the researchers. Indirect evidence is different facts that if they turn out to be true, which is, you know, is a big if it turns out to be true, then you can infer that this evidence proves, you know, the existence of a virus. So, you know, it's a key distinction to make that they do not have the direct evidence, they have this indirect evidence. And the first form of indirect evidence would be the cell culture method, which is where they are taking the sample from a human. We'll just use SARS-CoV-2 as an example because that's on everyone's mind. So in this instance, they took the lung fluid of a single patient, and you know, they'll take that fluid and they might centrifuge it a little bit, maybe try and get rid of some of the bigger particles, and then they add that to a culture of, in this case, it was the kidney cells from an African green monkey. And so they take the sample from the human, put it in the cell culture. They'll mix that with different antibiotics, antifungals, fetal cow serum, the blood from a baby calf, and other chemicals and nutrients. And they'll incubate that for a few days, and they'll look to see if they get what is called the cytopathogenic effect, which is, you know, the breakdown of the cell as it's been starved and poisoned. So they're literally creating the effect that they want to see, and then claiming that when they get this effect, that is proof of their virus. So it's indirect evidence that they're creating in a lab, trying to claim the existence of these pathogenic particles. And so that's not a valid dependent variable, because they're creating their effect that they're observing, and they don't have the viruses to begin with in order to, you know, see that effect. So that's one form of indirect evidence. The next one would be the electron microscopy images that you'll see of these scary particles, the scary pathogenic particles. And again, what they're doing with these, they're taking, you know, the supernatant from this cell culture. And so at this point, it's already heavily altered. You know, the sample has gone through the cell culture process. It's not purified. It's not free of contaminants. It's not free of foreign materials, pollutants. It's not free of different, you know, things outside of the particles. It's not just the particles, the viruses itself. It's a mixture. It's not isolated. So they take that heavily altered sample and they'll put it through this electron microscope preparation, where they fix the sample. They kill it with formaldehyde and glutaraldehyde. They will stain it with different heavy metals. Well, first they'll dehydrate it, I believe, with different concentrations of ethanol. Then they'll stain it with heavy metals. They'll put it in epoxy resin, cut it into thin sections, and then bombard it under an electron microscope with all this heat. And so, again, you're taking an already heavily altered sample and putting it through more alterations, taking images from this heavily altered sample, and then claiming that the particles that you see at the end were actually in the person to begin with, which at that point is so far removed from reality. You know, how can you say that the particles that you're picking out in these images were actually in the person to begin with? And, you know, it's interesting, as I've been doing research into this, the recent one I was looking into was the Marburg virus, and the electron microscope, the person who was doing that wrote a paper and said it took them, like, I believe, days to try and find the particles in these electron microscope images. And the person, the lead researcher, actually left. They were frustrated. They couldn't find the virus that they were looking for, and he left and then came back an hour later and they're like, oh, there it is. So they were just looking through this unpurified sample and found the particles, these filaments that they'd said, oh, we haven't seen those before. We call it the point and declare method. You know, you're looking for the representative particle that you believe is your virus and then claiming that is without actually, you know, proving that to be the case. So electron microscope imaging, again, another form of indirect evidence. Another one that they like to use is antibodies. So they're saying that these results with these antibodies are evidence that the virus is within a sample. We run into problems here because antibodies, again, never been purified and isolated directly from the fluids of a human. These are just different chemical reactions. And like viruses, antibodies existed first as an idea. You know, it was a concept that was created to explain these reactions. And they have no less than six theories trying to explain the form and function of these entities. So, you know, you can't use one fictional entity to try to explain the existence of another fictional theoretical entity, which is what they're trying to do with these antibody results. If they get them, they claim that they're specific to a certain virus, and that proves the existence of this virus. But what you find out when you do research antibodies is that these results regularly are not specific. You know, they don't just go on to the virus that they're looking for. These reactions bind to all sorts of different things. And antibody research in itself is embroiled in the reproduction crisis, or they can't reproduce and replicate the antibody results. So, you know, these, again, it's just another form of indirect evidence that they're trying to use to infer the existence of these viruses. That leads us to genomic or genomes, the data that they will use to try and create a genome to say that this virus exists. And these are just, you know, random ACTGs in a computer database that they've cobbled together off of these unpurified samples. So once again, in the case of SARS-CoV-2, it came from the lung fluid of a single patient. I don't believe they even did any sort of centrifugation, if I remember correctly. They just did a metagenomic sequencing, which, you know, you're going to find a bunch of host material, different things, bacteria, fungus, all these different elements that will be sequenced along with the theoretical virus.
Thanks, and so, Mike.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Am I going too long? So
no, that's okay.
Basically, different forms of indirect evidence.
Yeah. I think you've outlined all the methodological problems in this whole area called virology. And the key thing for me from that is they're working with an idea and they're projecting an idea into what they're observing. And that's really profoundly unscientific. So that's a really important issue, the virtual. You know, they're looking at the idea, they're obsessed with this idea. And you can see from the history of it, they've been obsessed with it from the 19th century onwards, this idea of there being this unseen agent that they can cut, they think they can culture, and they think that they can envisage in all sorts of ways. And they can only capture it in these cultures, they say, but they can't actually identify it materially as a real entity, a material biological phenomenon that you can see, you can sense in all sorts of direct ways. They can only do it in indirect ways. And I think this sort of leads into this issue about the virtual and the whole abstraction from reality that you see in this practice called virology, which in a sense isn't a science, as in a predictive discipline that can predict and it can control in terms of experimentation, and it can replicate its experiments and find exactly the same findings. And I think this brings us on to talk a little bit about this whole area of the virtual. And I wonder if we could bring in Eric here to tie in, because Eric's done a lot of work. Eric Coppolino, investigative journalist and astrologer, has done a lot of work recently on this whole area of how virology and COVID and SARS-CoV-2 actually is a virtual phenomenon, and ties in with this sort of transhumanist agenda at some point. So Eric, could you perhaps jump in here?
Good morning to everyone from New York. And thank you, Kevin. Hi, Dolores. Hi, Mark and Mike. The whole thing that we've witnessed is all going on inside of computers. I think people have this idea that virology is going on in a laboratory, and maybe some part of it is going on inside of a laboratory. But when you actually look at what's going on, it's almost entirely a computer phenomenon. And I think that defies most people's comprehension of what a physical science like virology is. When you tell people that you've dug up some rock, you know, you're studying a rock, they expect you to actually have a rock. And when you're studying a star out in space, they expect you to actually have the star out in space. And when you're studying a bunny rabbit, they expect you to have the bunny rabbit. But with virology, somehow no one actually has the virus, but what they have is a kind of a representation of what they claim is the virus that's in a computer program. And when you start to look at what they're actually doing, you find out that it really has absolutely nothing to do with the physical world. All of the brew going on that Mike was talking about, all of their monkey pus and calf pus and everything else, it's almost like it's an excuse basically to make it seem like they've done something that is going to be repeatable or has a basis in physical reality. But very quickly, all of that is going on inside of a computer, and they're doing all this alignment, and they're running computer programs over and over again, basically. And I don't think that's something that's widely understood. And I'm finding in explaining this over and over again that one of the best ways to explain what's going on is to say this is not happening in the real world. It's happening inside of the processor on a computer. And people do understand that. They understand the concept of a simulation as opposed to a real thing. There's still enough awareness of that. We're not so deep into the world of deep fake. But what we really are talking about, and this is starting to get some traction in the press. I think there might have been a 60 Minutes on it a few weeks ago, and you'll see articles starting to pop up, is that there's this thing now called a deep fake, which is a computer simulation. We could have the Dolores Cahill deep fake based on collecting hundreds of hours of your broadcasts and your vocal patterns, and then making a script, and this little digital puppet of Dolores comes on the air. You can be floating around on a sailboat in the Bahamas, and a brand new show is still happening. And this is the best approximation of what's been going on with virology that I can think of. But the second problem is that people's minds have been changed. I mean, really, it's the first problem. It's more like the prime cause, is that people's entire set of references have been completely scrambled and put back together by all overexposure to all of this technology. And it has not left people with any natural innate or with much intelligence that they can access because they have been so disoriented by being completely over immersed in digital technology for the past 20 years, even longer. All of your young people are now digital natives. They grew up with a computer on the kitchen table, or were handed a phone, a cell phone, when they were two. And that has, in a sense, ruined people's ability to reason through issues like this. And so in a way, they have become part of the problem themselves, because when someone's mind is in digital state, you can convince them of almost anything. And we've long been, first of all, convinced, trained about the existence of viruses by having the needle shoved in our arm so many times, right? That's very convincing, right? When you're two and they shove the needle in your arm, you think there must be a good reason for this. It must be really doing something. This is a complete violation of your whole physical reality. This is not a pill that you take. Even that's more natural. You peel some bark off a tree. Okay, no, this is just they're gonna go in through some mystery pathway, shoving this liquid into your body. That's convincing. And on top of that, add this complete transformation by computers, and part of that conditioning means to be completely faithful of anything claiming to be high tech. And so the way back at the beginning, I was in a conversation here. How many minutes? A minute?
No, I was just going to say, Eric, thank you very much for that. Seconds. And just if it's okay.
Yeah, so there you go.
We'll come back to you after the break, but just on the Dolores Cahill Show and with my guest host of Kevin Corbett and my guests, Mike Stone and Dr. Mark Bailey, and also Eric Coppolino. We're just going to go to a quick ad break and we'll be back again in 2 minutes.
You should hear what George Eliason is talking about.
One of the great frontline journalists, incredible in Syria and now across Donbass, Eva Green Bartlett.
Hi, George. Thank you so much, my friend, for having me back on.
What's been going on there? What are you seeing now, reporting on?
These nefarious, they're known as petal or butterfly mines. Their technical name is PFM-1. They're deployed by munitions. Ukraine is supplying them by rockets filled with cluster munitions. So according to emergency services here in Donetsk, I was told that each rocket contains 12 cluster munitions, and each cluster contains 26 mines, making a total of over 300 mines in one rocket alone. So since July 28th, Ukraine has been firing on different districts of Donetsk. Mostly they land without exploding, and that's the insidious part, is that they're so small that it's very easy to miss them. And Ukraine has rained these down on residential, civilian, non-military areas. So the evening that they were fired on, the very center of Donetsk, not even the periphery, but the very heart of Donetsk, where I was staying, and people that were on the streets, if they stepped on them, they will lose a foot. Cars were driving over them and having tires blown out.
George Eliason on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702. Or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
TMT.
I'm tired of it.
I don't know where to begin.
Everybody's tired of it.
TMT.
I call it the oh my God virus.
Why do we give them the power?
Absolutely stupid.
Of course, it's ridiculous.
And it just goes along with everything else.
For them to actually mandate a vaccine.
Get the straight talk from us.
Time for us to be bold and be strong.
TMT.
And I wanted to thank you for that.
Telling the truth is the only mandate we believe in.
When you get into the facts and logic and reason thing, it drives me crazy because you're right.
TMT Radio.
I just was calling to give you my 2 cents.
TMT Radio. Live.
Eric, you were talking about the whole virtual issue and the fact that these so-called viruses are computer constructs, really. They're algorithmic creations, and that people don't really understand this. And what do you think is the issue here about bringing this to a wider audience, this what actually is happening, which is a, you know, this in silico modeling, this computer generated material which doesn't have any direct translation to something from nature. It's not even a surrogate of something from nature.
I think we have to keep talking about it over and over again until we find language that people resonate with. So this is one of the reasons why I've been writing the current series of articles that I'm doing now. I've moved that project onto Substack, where I'm just basically explaining this over and over and over again from different angles, conducting a kind of an experiment to see what resonates with people, what concepts they identify with, to introduce the concepts behind the technical language before introducing the technical language and the technology, because when you go from the concept to the word, the concepts are easy, and so you go from the concept to the word to the technique, I think you may get a better result. So when we have to explain this to the human race, we're having to explain it to people who are enamored of technology and hypnotized by technology, but don't understand technology. They don't know the words. And so this is all a very long experiment in plain talk. One of the reasons why I thought Sam Bailey was the most engaging presenter I had ever seen is because she is the expert in plain talk, in getting it out of the technological jargon, because the jargon itself has a kind of a hypnotizing quality. And as Jesus did, we have to learn how to speak in metaphors that are simple enough that people can understand them. Now, people could go a long way toward understanding Jesus's very simple metaphors. I think those also get lost, but they're also heavily abused. But that idea of what is an example, what is this like? A good trial lawyer speaks like this. What do people know at the time they make a statement? This is a very important thing, and I think it's one of the we can maybe come back to that later, but a lot of the people who are dancing around the point that there is not a virus, who are refusing to answer the question, one of the things they're caught in is a thing I've seen liars caught in many, many times, which is that how do they come around to admitting when they knew what they knew? So the problem is if child of a famous politician, for example, does manage to admit that this doesn't exist, well, the question might be, well, when did you find that out? And so I think that when did you find that out question is causing a delay in people acknowledging what they know. And so another part of what we need to do is open the door rhetorically allow an opening for people to and maybe explain why they didn't follow this or put this all together. So we're having to translate between technology and real life, and that's not easy in a world where nobody really understands their technology that well. I do some customer service for my company, right, where I watch the emails go by, I pick up the phone, and it rings. And we live in a time when people have a hard time resetting a password. They cannot tell the internet from their email inbox. They are completely disoriented, dislodged, and confused. They don't know how to get around the physical world because it's got a voice from the sky giving them instructions. Whereas it's much easier to learn how to get around if you like to get lost and drive down that back road and see where it comes out on the other end. So that spirit of explore and experiment in the physical world is a thing that has to be stoked in people as curiosity. Where does that road lead? And so part of what I do as a writer is try to engage people and incite their curiosity in a certain way, and let their, like a therapy process, let their curiosity, their desire for self-actualization be driving the questions. And so I think if we can put good questions out, then we're doing ourselves a big favor. And yeah. As people who think about this all day long, right? I know everyone in this room except Dolores, who I've watched for many years now, 3 years, doing your thing with audiences. We should be practicing in little practice sessions, looking for the language, just like the people who thought this up. I would put a large sum of money on focus groups being behind a lot of the language of this, and I wouldn't be the least bit surprised if Frank Luntz personally ran the focus groups.
Yeah.
When you've got all this brilliant language like killing grandma, social distancing, You know, all this protect your neighbor BS. This came out of, far as I know, this came out of focus groups and the fear, they understand the fear. Now, the reason I'm saying this with such confidence is that Fauci himself said that they focus group influenza, cancer, AIDS. They are looking for the public to provide its language, then they turn it back to the public. We need to be doing that. We need to be watching our email inbox and listening to the stupid questions people are asking and the complaints they're making, and use all of that data to find the language to tell this story.
Well, what you're saying there, Eric, about virology, it was obsessed from the early days with technology and techniques. Mm. And the whole history of molecular biology as well, Dolores, is one from the 1930s where biological reality, the phenomena of biology, the materiality of the flesh, was superseded by physicists, by physics, by mathematics. Mm-hmm. And people were brought in or brought themselves into the field, funded by Carnegie and Rockefeller, to colonize the biological with the physical. So you had this superseding of the materiality with fiction, with abstraction, with mathematics. And you can see that in the way that the work on the bacteriophage was used to galvanize the whole model of pathogenic infectious viruses. Rather than looking at the whole thing objectively, they projected into this whole area this fiction of there being a virus, of there being an infection, of there being lysis, and they couldn't prove that model. It was disproved, and it still is disproved as a pathogenic infected model. And that's where we are today, because that's what the biotech and the pharma industries have got behind. It's been capitalized upon. It's been marketed. And it's been legitimated through all the regulatory mechanisms. And therefore, that's the end result. You know, if you accept the tenets, the axioms and postulates of virology, then you have a virus, you have social distancing, you have all this infection control, which is totally unnecessary if there is nothing there. And there isn't, I think, there isn't anything there. I think it is a fiction. I think it's like the 19th century dilettante scientists. Now in the 21st century, they're not dilettantes running around on horseback. They're actually not amateurs. They're professionals with techniques and modern versions of 19th century amateur approaches, which are high tech. PCR tests, lateral flow tests, antibody tests. But these all depend on what Mike was talking about, the way that they manipulate the independent and dependent variables, the lack of proper research designs and controls, and the lack of proper, accepted experimentation, in canonical experimentation, the true experiment. They're doing one-shot case designs where they throw bits of a sample into a load of material. It's like an alchemy. It's like a witch's brew of genetic and biological confounding variables. And then, hey presto, they have CPE, cytopathic effect, which, as Mike was saying, is there's no metric to it. It's totally interpretive, depends on the subjectivity of the operator in the lab. This is not a science. This is a practice. It's really dilettante 19th century approaches dressed up with modern day techniques. And Mark, you've deconstructed this an awful lot in your first paper last year on the, where you went through all the pillars of the COVID con. And perhaps you could jump in here really and take this a little bit further.
Yeah, thank you, Kevin. And yeah, it would be a pleasure to build on what the rest of the panel have just talked about. So first of all, based on what Mike was saying about what is science, what is the scientific method, I'd like to start just by reading a short extract of a recent article I wrote called Warning Signs You Have Been Tricked by Virologists Again. And I added a wee postscript at the finish, and it was derived from Alan Chalmers, the philosopher of science, his book that he published in, it was a second edition, What is This Thing Called Science, in 1982. So I derived my postscript on his work and said, observational statements are frequently presupposed by theory. Such statements are always made in the language of some theory and will be precise as the theoretical or conceptual framework that they utilize is precise. So in this instance, a virus particle was not observed first, and subsequently viral theory and pathology developed. Scientists of the mid and late 19th century were preoccupied with the identification of imagined contagious pathogenic entities. The observations of that naive inductionist did not identify a virus a priori and then set about studying its properties and characteristics. The extant presupposition of the time was that a very small germ particle existed that may explain contagion. What came thereafter arose to fulfill the presuppositional premise. So the point of that is saying that essentially the virologists invented viruses in their minds and then went about trying to find observations which would confirm their theory, which is a completely backwards way of going about things. And I think what few people realize is that since the 1800s, virology has essentially remained what we call a descriptive science. Now, when a science is new, when it's something completely unknown to humanity previously, a descriptive science, that's fine. We start to observe, make some speculation about what could be going on. And really, it's just a starting point. Some sciences are stuck as descriptive at the moment. So for things like describing planets or stars, etc., we can't really do experimental studies. We can't do controlled studies to test if our hypotheses are correct. So they remain descriptive sciences. But for virology to remain as a descriptive science in the year 2022 is absolutely preposterous. And we think that it's been kept this way to maintain the illusion that viruses actually exist. So realistically, when the light microscope was invented, and certainly by the 1700s and the 1800s, the scientists and doctors were observing microbes under the microscope and trying to reach conclusions about what they might do, whether they cause disease, etc. That's all fine. That's all descriptive science. But once you're at that point, it should become an experimental science, as Mike alluded to earlier, where you start dealing with independent variables and controlled experiments. But we can see that virology has not been doing that for the last 140 years. It's simply remained in this descriptive phase. So initially in the late 1800s, it was thought to be some sort of fluid contagion. By the early 1900s, they thought it was an infectious protein. And by the 1950s, it became the modern model that we have today, which is the rogue genetic code surrounded by a protein coat that passes around causing infections and is replication competent. The problem with that is that each reincarnation of the virus has not been backed up by following scientific method with controlled experiments. And we can see that certainly in the 1970s, they were attempting to purify what they thought were viral particles. But there were a number of problems. One was that the particles could never be found directly from a living host. And that's a major problem. Now, we see all sorts of excuses that the virologists make up about this, from that there's just not enough to it's just not practical, etc. But then we find that it's a completely inconsistent model, because if there's not enough virus load to detect, then how on earth is it causing damage within the body? And we're also getting other explanations, such as a sneeze might contain 200 million viruses. And yet when we capture a sneeze and put it under the microscope, we can't see one virus in there. So again, we just see excuse after excuse as to why the scientific method can't be applied, essentially. So one of the important activities that's taken place in the last 2 years, particularly with regards to SARS-CoV-2, is Christine Massey and allies' work that's been taking place with their Official Information Act request. And one thing that's become very apparent is that none of these institutions, whether it's the CDC or the major universities and private institutions, have been doing controlled experiments. So when they're claiming that they've cultured a virus, that they've come up with the genomic sequence of a virus, whether they've created a PCR or antigen test, which they say detects the virus, whether they've come up with an antibody test, which they say predicts exposure to the alleged virus. None of these things have been done with properly controlled experiments. So they're all completely invalid. And I think what's happened is that people are waking up to this and we're sort of closing in on the virologists and there's not a lot of room for them to move anymore. So some of the excuses we're seeing now are just getting, quite frankly, ridiculous. So Christine and her team have shared with me some of the pertinent responses from some of the major institutions. And the excuses we're getting are anything from it's too much work to generate the data or it's going to cost too much money, right through to it poses a threat to national security, through to alleging that we may be creating some sort of bioweapon. Now, this is all completely ridiculous because all we've asked for in these instances is just to show us the control experiment that took place so we can see that there was an independent variable. So if they are doing a cell culture, we're just saying to them, that's fine. You're saying that the cytopathic effect and the particles that you're seeing in the culture are viruses. Why don't you just do it with a controlled experiment? Now, we're not talking about negative controls, which they like to give us, which is simply adding water, culture media to the sample. We need to see a proper positive control where they add the same sort of biological specimen. So in this case, it might be some fluid from the nose or from the lung. But this particular sample doesn't contain the alleged virus. That's what an appropriate positive control experiment is. But we can see that they simply do not do this, or if they have been doing it, they don't disclose it to us. And we know from Stefan Lanka's experiments that he did last year that you can generate all of these things, whether it be the cytopathic effect in a cell culture or a genome alleged to come from a virus. You can simply do this through a control experiment where you don't add anything that possibly contains what they alleged to be a virus. Now, many of us have been aware that this has been going on for a long time, so this is not something new. But as Kevin and Eric have been suggesting, we're trying to work out ways to engage more of the public so they know what's going on. And one of the initiatives we launched in mid-July was the Settling the Virus Debate Statement, which is essentially a public challenge to the virologists, just saying, well, you're telling us that your PCR and your cell cultures and your genomics are detecting viruses. So we'd just like to see you, firstly, on your own terms, just to see if you've got any internal validity with what you do. Do the same thing, but this time do it blinded so that you don't know the nature of the samples that you're getting. So we came up with the basic protocol involving split samples that we'd send to 5 different labs around the world. And we'd ask them to see what they could find in each sample. Tell us, does this sample contain a virus or not? Does this sample contain a viral genome or not? And for the first time, apparently in history, we'd see if they can even perform with any form of internal validity on their own terms. Now, we don't even think that that would prove the concept of viruses. It would just be step one to say, with what's being presented to the world currently, does it show what they're doing have any scientific merit whatsoever? So interestingly, we put the statement forward in the middle of last month, so we're almost 6 weeks now, and not once has anyone stepped forward and said that you guys are mistaken because these tests have already been done. These experiments have already been done. Now, that is staggering. That is an absolute staggering admission, because shouldn't this stuff have been done with fully controlled experiments, not just once, but multiple times and tested? So I think that was the first incredible revelation. And obviously the second is that the establishment don't want anything to do with it. We've had some attacks from the health freedom community, interestingly, but the the virologists themselves, I think they can see that it's just a matter of time.
That's
now.
Great. Thank you very much, Mark, if that's okay. We're just going to come at the end of the first hour. And our guest today, of course, the host is Kevin Corbett, and we have Mike Stone from America, Dr. Mark Bailey from New Zealand, and also Eric Capolio from America. And we're just now going to, at the top of the hour, to take a break for the news. And we'll be back for the next hour on the Dolores Cahill Show on TNT Radio.live.